Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Popcorn Book Club. This week, we are going in for some screen time, talking the V for Vendetta film adaptation from 2005, directed by James McTeague, written by the Wachowski sisters, and also sort of people in the know think it was sort of shadow directed by the Wachowski sisters because it has some of their sort of like visual flares, and they were like unit two directors. But all that to say, it's a movie starring Natalie Portman and Hugo Weaving as V, and I'll go on the record as saying it's my most basic opinion, but I really like this movie.
Me too.
I also like it. I will say, though, since I've seen this movie many times, including once a couple of months ago, I think that after reading the graphic novel, it definitely shifted my perspective of it in terms of looking at it as not just a movie that I like, but also as an adaptation. Mm. And one of the things that comes in very early on is the idea of like romance. And in that very first opening scene where we see Guy Fawkes being hanged, there's the like, but what of the man? And we see the woman who's like his wife or whoever in the crowd. And I'm like, oh, I don't care for that. Like watching it again, I was like, I don't think we needed to start with this. I think we could have started with the two of them getting ready. I think that this was unnecessary.
Yeah, I will say where I think the biggest misstep of this movie is the little romance between V and Evie. I don't think it needs it. That felt very like an unnecessary Hollywood thing. But other than that, I think this is better than the book. I think it's cleaner. I think it makes more sense.
I said last week, I think that it's better than the book, and I do stand by that. But I definitely did see it in a different light in terms of adaptation. And there were some things that I was like, oh, it makes so much sense that they did this instead of that. And there were other things where I was like, that really does, like, Alan Moore is kind of right. This does really change the way that the thesis is perceived.
And if you note, Alan Moore at the end doesn't have his name in the credits. It just says
at all
from the novel, graphic novel illustrated by David Lloyd. It doesn't.
Oh, I did not know that.
He's like, nope.
Oh, yeah, no, he just disavowed himself. Okay. He was like, I ain't write this. I don't know what this trash is, but I did not write it.
I mean, it's such a bold stance, like, just to be like, I hate it. I thought he refused to, he didn't watch it either. He just read the screenplay and like, was like, I hate this, which is funny to me because my reaction to this movie was I loved it. I thought the script, the adaptation from a script perspective was a plus, like just so like taking out all of the ideas and streamlining and making it really compelling and really making it about Evie. I thought the directing was a little B movie. Like, I think I wish the Wachowskis didn't just shadow direct it. I wish they directed it.
I know that you mean B, like A versus B, but I was thinking B movie starring Jerry Seinfeld. You said it, yes, so I'm sorry, I'm giggling.
It has a lot of similarities to B movie starring Jerry Seinfeld. A lot of the same motifs and themes. I think it was like, no offense to the director, but it felt like almost a director trying to be the Wachowskis and wasn't quite as adept.
To be fair, I mean, James McTeague has not had a long career after this movie.
No.
His biggest credit up until this movie was assistant director on Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones.
A beloved movie by all moviegoers.
This was his first feature film.
I think it was cool that the Wachowskis, when I looked it up, because I was like, why didn't they direct this? And I got very up in arms about it. And I was like, oh, they didn't want to. They wanted a break and wanted to just kind of direct from the side and maybe probably get more sleep. So they brought up their first AD, which is a cool thing to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised
that Alan Moore hated it so much when I thought there were so many little love notes mm-hmm. to the book in this movie. There are just all these wonderful Easter eggs, like the dolls in Prothero's shower, where mm-hmm. they don't talk about how he's an avid doll collector, but like if you've read the book, you know, and it's a fun little nod. Or the showgirls in their showgirl costume on Daddy Dietrich's show.
And you also reference, there's a little tiny little clip of Storm Saxon.
Yeah.
A little moment.
Laser Girl is banging.
And I think if you watch it for a second, you see that the villain is like a really racist caricature of an Arab person, which does feel like in 2005, and I mean, that it was a little more Bush era, what the racist villain absolutely would be on a show like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I particularly liked this adaptation for the character choices that were made, like letting Evie have a lot more agency, putting her in a position as someone who works in the like state media news station. Also loved the choice of how V was directed and how he's like much more charismatic, much more like kind of devilish and fun. And I also liked the choice that they made for Finch too, to actually like let that like the very final panel in the book now feels appropriate for the Finch that was depicted in the movie. This person who is like has been working under the thumb of this terrible authoritarian government and is starting to see how bad they are and is trying to piece together the puzzle. And in the end makes the choice to let Evie send that train to Parliament.
I love that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I loved that.
The fact that she frames it as hope, I think really gives me chills. I will get to it, but the end of this movie, when everyone's removing their masks and we get whisper quick flashes of her parents and of Valerie and of Gordon. Oh, I'm getting chills just saying it. I find the end.
I'm such a wimp. I'm like, oh, he's so good. They're all there and he's them and they're him and it's an idea.
It's effective. It's cathartic.
It really is effective.
It's super cathartic. It's the cathartic ending that we wanted from that we talked about last week of just like, there's hope, and also V goes out the way that V wants to go out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
So I really love that they make Evie older. I think it is weird that she's 16 in the graphic novel. Mm-hmm. I am uncomfortable with it, especially when she gets into that intense sexual relationship in book two. But something else that I really like, I love the scene where V is introduced and where Evie is introduced to V, because as I was reading the latter half of the graphic novel, I was like, why do I like V? Like, I don't think I do. And in the movie, watching the movie again, I was like, oh, that's why I've always liked this character, because he's definitely still a little like not all there all the time and doesn't think the way that I think we would think as your lay people who are not theater people who took one poli-sci class, but like in that scene where he does his like monologue with all the V's and voila, in view of vicissitude, blah, 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 blah.
Ooh, Karama.
I did three V's. I cannot do the whole thing. There was a point where I was like, I'm going to learn this when I was like 20, I think. And then I was like, I'm not gonna learn this. But I love, like, when Evie asks him, who are you? And he says, who is but the form following the function what? And what I am is a man in a mask. And then she's like, right, I can tell that. And he's like, right, I'm just saying you don't ask somebody in a mask who they are. And, like, I love that, like, it's like the Brits say, they got good banter, yeah?
Yeah, and Tian, you're totally right that, like, he is way more fun and funny in this than he is in the graphic novel. I also really, if we're talking character changes, I really love what they do with Gordon, who's played by Stephen Fry.
Oh, I love him. My favorite character in the movie. Yeah.
He's basically an invention for the film. The only similarity is he's, you know, an older man who Evie comes to for, like, protection and safety. But in the film, if you haven't seen it, Gordon is a host of a television program, and he's famous and has money.
He's Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, he's Lorne. Well, and he hosts the show.
He's Stephen Colbert.
He's more Stephen Colbert.
The first night that Evie's out on the streets, she wasn't trying to work her first night as a prostitute. She was going on a date to visit Dad Gordon Dietrich at his house.
Daddy Dietrich.
Daddy Dietrich at his house. But we find out that he sort of invites her as a front, that he is a closeted gay man, and that he, you know, is a member of this party, but is secretly rebellious. He, you know, has a copy of the Quran. He has banned art. And eventually he's arrested and killed in a way that, maybe as someone who works in media, I found so affecting, because you sometimes think that, like, money or fame or at least, like, public attention will save you. It's very much like,
I mean, he thought that.
Yeah, he thought that. He was like, I'm fine.
He thought that he was going to have to do a boring fundraiser and pay a fine after doing a show that made fun of the chancellor.
And you
will die.
I think it's viscerally scary to see someone like that then get his, it's not comeuppance, but then get punished. That was, like, the moment where I'm like, oh, this government is fucking scary. Mm-hmm. And I felt that fear so viscerally, because he was someone with what should have been power, but then was made powerless.
Yeah. I do also feel like I should point out Daniel, my husband, worked for a talk show for a very long time. He worked for Colbert. And every time he has seen the show that Dietrich puts on, he points out that it is a terrible show.
It's very dumb and done
to Benny Hill music. But
it's
very effective.
It's very British.
I've seen Monty Python. Like, they could have done a lot better.
So Danny Dietrich puts on this appallingly bad, like, vaudeville sketch making fun of the Chancellor. And I think that's actually really effective, because I think to any modern audience, that show is very bad. And everybody in their society loves it. Yeah. Like, that is the most rebellious thing they have seen in decades. It is wildly subversive by their standards. I think it's intentionally bad. I know my husband just thinks the people making this movie had no idea what talk shows are and had indeed never seen them.
Well, it's interesting that you said decades, because what's really weird about this movie and watching it again, the timeline for how long they've been under this dictatorship was much shorter than I had imagined it in my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
because,
10 years?
They were still making regular... No, it was less, because in Valerie's thing, because the years have been shifted, obviously, for the film, because the film came out in 2005, so they were like, we're not going to set this in the 90s. This is... I think it'll resonate more if we set it in the future, which is, it's set in 2020. So she says, in 2005, I came out to my parents or whatever. And then in 2000, I think 15 was when she was taken.
But we know that maybe they only came for gay people later, because Evie's parents were taken
when she was 12.
Yeah. And we can assume that she's probably 22 now. Or younger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But so I assumed maybe, like, they came for political dissidents first, and then it just got worse and worse and worse. And also, I think we also have to assume that Valerie was hiding for a while, that they maybe weren't public about their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair. I mean, Valerie was also a movie star.
Like, yeah.
Valerie might have had the protection that comes from being a wealthy white woman in almost any society for a while, until she didn't, much like Gordon Dietrich.
That whole thing made me cry.
It's so beautifully. The Valerie sequence is maybe one that is the closest to the novel, and I think it really works. What do you guys think?
I agree.
It's my favorite part of the movie.
85% verbatim from the graphic novel, I would say. There were just like slight changes that I noticed having read it very recently. I was like, oh, okay. But I think that they were changes that were meant to honor and uplift the story, not to take away from it. I think generally the changes in the movie were made to honor and uplift the story.
To me, read as people who really loved the graphic novel.
They love it. It's very clear they love it.
I mean, I love the choice too of like getting... like going back and forth between Valerie and also Evie, like going through the motions or being tortured and like coming back to the story I loved that sequence. Also loved the outfits that those lesbians wore to come out to her parents. Yeah. I was like, this is what you think? This is amazing. These outfits are insane. Loved seeing like, when was this movie made?
2005.
Like, 2005. Like 2005 dystopian lesbian clothes. I was like, nailed it. Loved it.
There was a tiny thing that I realized watching it again this time. Because again, this is probably like the fifth time I've seen it. He says that the notes were passed to him the same way that they were passed to her in the cell, which I'm like, cool, cool, cool. And then I remember that his entire body was burned in a fire. Where were the notes made of toilet paper?
He's the one who set the fire. So maybe he...
Oh, yeah, he set that fire. So and yeah, then he emerged
it, but he
like
walked
a phoenix.
Through it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And his entire body was burned.
Maybe he...
And it's paper.
Maybe he hid those to pieces.
He wanted to save it.
Or maybe he memorized it. I imagine he read it like hundreds of times.
I feel like he put it in like... He was collecting things. He put in a little tube. He put the tube up his butt, right before he lit the... But I will say, to that end, I really liked the detail of seeing V's hands. Like, I thought that was a really good, like, creepy but perfect moment of, like, seeing the hands. And because that's all you need to understand is, like, that he is not the man behind this mask. And then it kind of puts that to rest in a way that is, like, delicate and, like... You see her at first kind of shirk back and then have this sympathy and like wanting to know more. And it gives you that point of interest of like, what did happen to him if you hadn't read the book? I really thought so many of the details that enriched V in this movie really made me love V a lot more. And to that end, I want to talk about Hugo Weaving.
Love Hugo Weaving.
We love Hugo.
We stan.
We stan Hugo. I feel like we were talking about this on our thread, but just to bring listeners in that like, who was it? I have it pulled up. That James Purifoy was hired to play V, but then he like couldn't get into the mask stuff and was fired. And then Hugo Weaving, who played the villain in The Matrix, who... That performance in and of itself, I think, is just completely underrated.
He was in LOTR.
Came in and was like, I can use my mask work from the theater. And I'm like, great, we have a nerdy theater major coming in, playing V. It is perfect. I still felt the real theater major... annoying theater major flair. I wrote at some point when he was putting up all those dominoes. I was like, the dominoes are just for him. And it's like, he's just for him. Weeks putting up those dominoes. Do you know how long it takes putting up dominoes?
And it takes a really long time. I read on the like trivia page on IMDb that it took thousands of hours for multiple people to put together those dominoes.
Yeah, because they probably fucked up a bunch of times.
And they were experts. They were domino experts. Is V a domino expert? I don't think so. And also, I will say, the dominoes are lifted directly from the graphic novel. But it was a much less elaborate setup in the graphic novel. They were like, we're just going to do the outline and then the circle. Like, we're good.
Yeah, but they filled it in.
I got different colors. filling it in, mm-hmm. gonna knock it down, like thousands of hours.
I mean, how many times, I'm just thinking like for prop work.
Oh, he didn't even call Evie in like, hey, Evie, look at this. Look at this. This is going to be really cool. Look.
Didn't record it like, for the brand.
I know that I'm like, I don't live my life for other people and like you should try like doing things just for you more. But if I set up all those dominoes, I would definitely like call my mom.
Yeah, like, I care with people. Like, I take a mommy. Picture.
Yeah,
take a picture. He did a really good job.
Yeah.
And I'd be proud of myself. And it's like, I don't want to say it's weird that he does it just for himself. But in this particular instance, I was like, I don't get it. Like, this is elaborate.
Okay, I have to go set up thousands of dominoes just for me. I'll be back.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Slightly back to the film, I think the movie makes a very strong choice to want to tie everything up in a much neater package than the book does, where first there's V, his first main announcement at Jordan Tower is the day after, or I guess the day of November 5th. And he says, in 1 year, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to do this. So the entire movie has the entire time frame of 1 year. But also,
I loved that.
Me too. And also maybe
it was smart screenwriting. Just like put a clock on it. That's what they tell you. Yeah.
Put a clock on it. But also the most like come together thing that I think they do is something totally different that's not in the book, but the idea of this St. Mary's virus. That there was there are these testing facilities, Lark Hill, like these concentration camps. But at these concentration camps, the testing that they were doing on V, which wasn't really specified in the graphic novel, if I recall, was, we find out in the film, was genetic warfare. Not genetic, viral warfare, which is like now illegal under the Geneva Convention, I think. Mm-hmm. But they were coming up with what they thought would be the next atom bomb, which was a virus as a weapon. So that is specifically what they were testing at this place where V was. And then we find out, or the detective discovers, that the government actually used this St. Mary's virus on their own people, said it was Islamic extremists, and then used that to overthrow the government, which is a not so, I mean, it's a little Bush did 9/11, but a not so veiled connection, though, to like, well, when there's an act of extreme terrorism from an outside force,
government consolidates power under nationalist identity. Like, that is something historically that happens.
I mean, and also that they have the cure too. That was a big part of it.
Yeah. It would be crazy if they like called it something like the China virus or something, right?
Oh yeah, like, well that wouldn't be topical.
I mean, that whole part when they were showing the newspapers and it was like
80,000. It was 80,000 dead.
And the government
today we hit 250,000. Yeah.
Yep. And it was just like, oh, even in like the wildest imagination of the Wachowskis, that like 80,000 dead to a government would be like ruining. And it's appalling. Like, I guess not.
Imagine if people found out that the government had done nothing and they were like, we love those guys. Vote them in for another term.
Let's
I literally had to take a nap after I saw that. I was like, I can't. I just paused the movie and took a nap because I was like, that's to me not even that many people.
To me, oh god, reference like hearing a film too reference like you can't leave quarantine. I was like, oh,
I know. It was a real bummer.
This is a real bummer.
It also made me very sad because the government, like, specifically probably like targeted the St. Mary School because, like, oh, an attack on children is so atrocious.
Of the Irish,
yeah.
It turns out there are going to be a lot of people being like, you should open up St. Mary's. Yeah. Like, if some die, some die.
That's what I was thinking. Like, oh, just like open up schools. No big deal. That's the thing.
It's everything is worse than any dystopian director could have possibly imagined.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was interesting also how there was, I mean, Alan Moore complains that it's very American and not British the way he wanted it to be. But I do think it's interesting that it seems that
I was just going to say
that. It's funny to me that I used to think that, like, I was like, yeah, she's doing it. And watching it this time, I was like, she's trying.
She's doing something.
Love you, girl. Yeah. But that she needed a better dialect coach.
Yes.
But what I was going to say was there's this scene where Creedy is talking to Finch. And he's basically accusing Finch of doing his job poorly on purpose because he sympathizes with the terrorists. And he's like, well, your family's Irish, right? It's terrible what St. Mary's did to the Irish. And there is like a lot of subtle, but there is a lot of like racism toward the Irish. Even before Prothero dies, he's talking about his Irish lighting director of photography.
He calls him a paddy.
Yeah, he calls him a paddy. He's like, I don't want to see him there. Get rid of him. He doesn't know how to light me. If you don't get a new DOP tomorrow, things are going to be bad for you. And I'm like, things are about to be real bad for you. I mean, bet you wish you weren't racist in your last moment.
People have to find new people to be racist.
Well, Melissa, please.
Oh, just while we're on Prothero, him in the shower with his massive screens all around him. Wow. Like, what? Does he jerk off to himself?
Yes. 100%.
Elon Musk has a bathroom like that. Just like,
those screens are big.
Why would you need it if you're not going to jerk off in the shower?
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, even if he's not physically jerking off, he is emotionally jerking off to the idea of him being the voice of England.
Okay, and but alternate idea that is more charitable than he deserves, maybe he can't stand to be alone with his own thoughts. Like, you know, do you ever have that thing where you have a lot of anxiety about, like, things going on? Like, you just need the television on in the background?
Yeah, but it doesn't need to be his own show.
That's a good point. He's mouthing along the words, too.
Jennifer, I love the thought of, like, you know, maybe he doesn't want to be alone when he takes a huge shit in this bathroom.
Maybe he's guilty. Maybe he feels guilty and doesn't want to think about it.
I mean, I think you're not wrong. There are elements of truth to that where it's like, yeah, these are people who don't want to think critically. They want to distract themselves constantly.
Well, and I think that, like, it's interesting looking at this from the perspective of it being made in 2005 before social media was the behemoth that it is now. Mm-hmm. Having all these screens in your bathroom does seem like bananas. But usually most of us have a screen in the bathroom with us now.
Yes,
it's true.
It's my only time.
2005, MySpace existed. Facebook was just about to, like, become a thing.
Facebook was a thing, but only in colleges.
Yeah, it was about to, it existed, but it was about to become like a revolution and destroy democracy as we know it. It's fine.
What kind of revolution are you talking there?
Yeah, because I joined Facebook, I think, in 2006. Yeah, and that was when you still needed to be a part of a network. Mm-hmm. And it was a big deal to us when they introduced no network, when anyone could join Facebook.
Mm-hmm. It destroyed Facebook.
Did you guys? Did you guys like when Evie, a thing that she does in the movie that she doesn't do in the book is when she opens the window for V, for the pedophile priest, that she's like, help me, I'm the terrorist, I want immunity, someone's going to murder you. And he thinks she's playing along. Mm-hmm. I thought that from a screenwriting point, in the moment, you're like, shut up, Evie. Mm-hmm. But from a screenwriting standpoint and also from like a narrative standpoint, it feels relatable where you're like, yeah, she has no loyalty to this insane guy. Mm-hmm. And also then it gives her like a chance to grow, to get on board with his ideology, because that maybe is what I would do if, you know, he let me out and is about to murder a guy.
I think that was one example of how the screenplay really worked for me in points when the directing did not, because there was something about like the way it was staged and directed and shot that I was like not in it emotionally with her. Like you weren't just with her in that moment. You didn't see moments of her right before feeling terrified. Like it didn't tell that story to me in that moment. So it felt very jarring. And maybe it was also because I just read the book and was expecting a different outcome. But like from a storytelling perspective, it felt very grounded. Like that's what a young woman would do who felt trapped and had no loyalty to this man. But I didn't fully buy it.
You're right. It would have been so much better if we got like a moment where she's like scared and like, so we see that internal thing. A good point. Thank you.
Rebuttal. It felt to me more calculated in terms of she had Daddy Dietrich's address on a slip of paper in the shadow gallery, and we see her looking at it, and she's like, you know what, you can do this. And then she takes a moment to try and then be like, oh, V, you know, I want to help more. How can I help? Mm-hmm. So it felt more like a woman in a domestic abuse situation trying to get out. And then in that moment with the priest, she's like very hurried because she's like, you have like 12 seconds to help me get out. And I've been planning this very carefully. And I need you to be better than you are in this moment and help me.
But also, why did she open the window for him?
Yeah, that felt confusing to me.
That was the one thing I couldn't wrap my head around.
Yeah.
I just felt like I didn't buy it from an emotional perspective. Like, I wasn't with her and worried for her in that moment. I was more like, oh, this is a turn, you know, not a way that she needs.
Also, her face is on the news all the time, right? Like, when she says, I know she's wearing pigtails, but when she says, I'm Evie Hammond, presumably he has seen many pictures of Evie Hammond.
I love that his response is like, ooh, I like this game. This is...
But it's also like
he's
a context.
Like, I'm just going to keep pedophiling.
It's a context thing where it's like, if you assume someone came from the agency, you're in that, you're primed.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been in situations
primed really
like that
me.
Where it's like I've seen a person's face a bunch of times. Dana, there was a time in college where we were waiting for a shuttle together, and you were talking to this guy who had just written a very controversial op-ed for the newspaper.
Oh,
and the whole
guy.
Time you were talking to him, I didn't realize it was him, and he kept looking at me like he was scared I was going to get mad at him because a lot of black people were mad at him.
Yeah, he sucked.
At that point. The op-ed basically implied that only white men with land should be able to
vote.
He
was like, yo, we settled that one a while ago.
That's...
Yeah. When he left and you were like, oh, that was, I'm not going to say his real name.
I forgot his real name. Don't say it.
Legal.
Don't say it.
I know it, but I'm not going to say it. But like, that was Righty McWriterson. And I was like, oh yeah, that was. So that I think I'll give him that he was expecting a child prostitute in that moment and not a terrorist.
I mean, look, I also think that is a little bizarre because in the book, Evie actually is very young. Like the fact that she's 16 means that she is a child. She would still look like a child. Natalie Portman looks 25.
Yeah.
And it implies that Natalie Portman is so hot, she cures pedophilia.
Well, she's very pretty and she's dressed in pigtails.
Sure.
Yeah, that's
yeah. When and he's like, this is great.
When that camera whips to reveal, I was like, this is a stretch. I'm sorry. But yeah. This is actually, this is too far.
Although V did have that costume ready to go.
Yeah. That's V has all costumes ready to go.
That's yeah, it true. Felt
I mean, there's that moment later in the movie where he dresses up like another person. And it's like, surprise, like it felt very much like he's the master of disguise.
It also felt like he, yeah, Natalie Portman's pigtail outfit, it felt like it was from another movie. Yes. Like I was like, oh, this is like a Hunger Games style.
Or I was like, did we just flip to like American Pie? Like what movie is this?
I will defend the movie by saying that is an almost exact replica of the outfit that Evie wears in the
movie. That's true.
But it doesn't fit the aesthetic of this movie.
It does not translate.
This graphic novel was written in the 80s.
I also feel like her betraying him in that way does change the way he betrays her later by like tricking her into thinking she's held prisoner. Like there is something I don't have a strong opinion of whether that's good or bad, but it is like, it's not just this like
the change.
Yeah. The change of him, of her trying to betray him is like, and then it feels a little vindictive that V did this thing to her.
And it's a little punishment-y.
Imprisoned
The fact that she did actively run away and then he captures her back and tortures her just in the abstract is gross.
That's yucky. Yeah, when you say that in those words in that order, I'm like, it's bad.
It's real bad.
Because it also, and this is why I also didn't like this choice, is I really liked in the movie after she goes through the process of false imprisonment and shaves her head and is freed and the rain and all that stuff is, the rain is beautiful and that whole sequence. When she leaves on her own volition and is like, what are you going to do? You're a wanted woman. She's like, I'm not afraid anymore. And she just walks away without a real plan.
But where does she go?
Yeah, where does she go?
I don't know where she goes, but I felt like to me, the more emotionally honest thing for her to do is to stay under V and not try to escape V with the priest because she is this wanted woman and she was afraid then. So I don't know.
I actually agree with you. Where I think a better way to have played it is that she is in on the plan. She did not prep it. She's not going to betray him with Gordon, you know, Gordon's address, the way they prep that. But in the moment when she's with the priest, she has a freak out.
Yes.
But then she comes. Yeah. I think they could have played that a little more grounded in a way that still makes her feel like she has agency and she's a three-dimensional character.
Yeah. But to go back to what you said, when she does leave V's lair and finds where did she go? How did she get that other apartment?
Yeah.
How did she get the like cinder block bookcase that she put together?
She does say fake ID. We just don't know how she gets it.
She says fake ID and that people don't.
Yeah.
I think they said something like, when people don't see me as Evie anymore. I think you changed more of me than, you know, I thought.
Her work friend hands her wallet and doesn't recognize her.
The logistics of it. I mean, if you live in a city long enough, you know where you can go to get a fake ID. Like, I know where to go in LA to get a fake ID.
I have no idea where to go to get a fake ID.
I've lived in Chicago for 10 years.
I grew up in LA also. So, like, I was a teenager, I knew where people would go to get fake IDs.
I did get a fake ID when I was a teenager or when I was, like, 19. But I don't know where that guy is. I mean,
there are places. Anyway, regardless, I'm not encouraging anyone to get a fake ID.
No, get a fake ID.
Where would I go to get a fake ID? Tell me how to do crimes.
Yeah. What do I want
to
do?
Well, you go to fakeidinmycity.org. But what I want to say, my take on the priest thing, and then I want to definitely move us away from that. I don't want to harp on it too much longer, but for me, the thing about the graphic novel, one, Evie is 16, and she is not aware that V has killed anyone other than the Fingerman at that point. Also, he didn't kill Prothero in the graphic novel. He just made him completely
insane. Almost, I would argue, way worse.
Which is scarier.
Yeah, scarier.
Definitely
I forgot
worse.
About that.
So she, in the movie, she knows that he killed Prothero. So she's like, oh, I'm with a murderer. Okay. Mm. And yeah. I think for me, her making that choice to try and extricate herself from the situation, like it was one thing when he was blowing up a building and like doing news broadcasts for like a revolution, but this is a whole other level. So I need to get out. And for me, the reason that she opened the window, because you asked that, and I did have to think about it. But for me, the reason that she opened the window is because she needs V to be able to come inside so that they can take him.
Oh.
So if she is able to help with the capture of V,
smart.
Then that she can get that amnesty that she is asking for. I'm not saying it was the best choice, but I'm saying this is how it makes sense.
Totally makes sense. Yeah. Thank you. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that is very grounded that someone who has lived within a system her entire life and works for this system would not want to immediately throw that all away for a murder stranger.
Mm-hmm. And she also does have the moment where she realizes that she maced the police officer, the detective, and she's like, why did I do that? So she kind of has her moments of helping him. She was unwitting in the beginning. She was like, I'll just go on a walk with this man that saved me from being raped by the police.
Sure,
and then he blows some stuff up. And then she actually assists him with crime. And then he kidnaps her. And then she finds out that he used her ID to go and murder the Voice of England. So I think that there's a progression there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He used her ID. I forgot
that. I forgot about that.
Karama, I'm back on board. Thank
you. Yeah, yeah. I'm here, too.
Yeah.
Okay, I gotta really quick go put my hair in pigtails and seduce a priest. I'll be back.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the plot, then she goes to stay with Gordon, which is a sequence that I genuinely love. Mm-hmm. I love
so Stephen sweet
Fry.
And so good.
I really like him as a character.
I do too.
Just
but
really
he's
cozy.
Very funny. He's one of the characters in this who is kind of a rare character in this who seems to have a really lovely sense of humor.
He makes her the eggs. What do you guys call that? In my family, we always called it hole
egg in a basket.
We called it hole in the eye, which doesn't make any sense.
But never, I have
egg in a basket.
That sounds terrifying. Yeah. We called it egg in a bird's nest in my house. Mm.
You've never had it, Tim?
No, I've never had. That was like, really I saw good. That. I was confused by what it was. I was like, what?
it's really good.
When I saw it the first time that V it made it, I was like, well, this is a cool dystopian breakfast.
Tim, trick yourself.
But no, go for it. It's fun. It's you use like British. A little glass and you cut out the middle and then you
can
fry
do it.
Together.
It's very easy.
All you need is
one slice of bread and one egg.
Okay, great. Yeah. I'll
and a cookie cutter.
I'll go
make it be a fun
butter.
Shape if you want.
What's it called? Hole in the eye?
That's what my family calls
it. Every calling stand list, it can be a lot of things.
Egg in a basket, bird's nest. Okay.
I also really like the storytelling of this storyline where it's, you know, in the beginning, you think he's a creepy older man that's trying to have sex with Evie and like Daddy Dietrich. And it's like, I, as soon as that was said, I'm like, ew. Like, I just was immediately like, I hate him. And then I saw him like, ugh, that guy. And then they go over and, you know, and we're like, oh, he's actually really sweet. And I was, when is he going to be a creep? And I was like, oh, no, he's not a creep. Yeah. He's just, and then it just became so lovely and such a sort of surprising relationship within this movie.
In many ways, he's like a version of V that continues to operate within this society. Yeah, he has his own secret room, too, where he has art and the Quran and things that would get him killed if anybody found out about them.
And then does, unfortunately.
And it does, yeah.
I did also wonder, though, like, did he have the secret room built first and then put the things in it? Or did he have the things and then put them in a secret room that he then had built? Like, what was the progression? And, like, how did he explain to the contractors what he was going to do?
You got to have a secret room first. You don't you don't get this stuff unless you have the secret room ready to go.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking. But then what do you say to the contractors? Do you say, like, this is my playroom? Like, you're Christian Grey? Like, what's the...
You can just say it's a panic room. A lot of people have panic rooms.
I didn't even think about that.
Or just make it a regular room and put a big bookshelf in front of it.
Yeah.
You know?
These are things that you think about in a dystopia. You got to prep your secret Quran room.
Did we ever get a sense of what his show was like before the...
No.
I think just like bad, like Carson...
British Chuck.
Yeah, like British panel show.
Yeah.
Like a bad version of the Graham Norton show.
Very Graham Norton.
Like perfect,
yeah.
I love Graham Norton.
I loved all the I loved all the portrayals of TV and media in this, because like the reporters as well, just to like kind of tangentially, but like the report, like the news reports felt very Fox News vibes, which like
she blinks a lot when she does a story she knows is false.
She knows isn't true. What I also loved, and it's such a minor detail of this movie, I love the shots of people watching television in their homes because you get to see how normal their homes look. And I think a lot of people think that, you know, if we lived in a dystopia, it would look like Soylent Green, like everything would be terrible and falling apart. And no, their homes look really lovely. Like at least one couple has some really nice built-in bookshelves. It looks really pleasant and normal. And that happens, right?
And there
like,
are
autocracy grows up around and you and things keep looking normal for a lot of people, unless you're a minority or a reporter or not straight or not cis, and then everything looks horrifying.
I think that's a really good point, and because it was connected to something that I like, the change of Evie having this job, because she as like a young, pretty white woman, she would have a job in this society. Yeah. And it does feel like she has that privilege, even if, and it is like comfortable for her, even if she is living in this authoritarian regime. And it does feel like in the book, the options for women are a lot more limited.
Way more limited. And she has a female boss in the movie.
Yeah, and that's why this feels more grounded and more relatable, especially to today, because it's like, oh, you can still have creature comforts in regimes that are very scary.
And I really like the choices of seeing the people, like the families at home. Because you don't get that in the book, really. Like, you don't get to see the effects of, like, what V is doing or what Evie's doing and what essentially what the government is doing either. But I love seeing, like, that one scene where the young girl starts to realize that the news is... And she, like, gets up and is like, bollocks. And I'm like, this is such a great tiny detail just to show that, like, what the idea that V is pushing is starting to, like, seep its way into people's consciousness.
And I think the movie makes a very smart choice of taking the core climax of the novel, which is that V is purposely sowing chaos to tear down this totalitarian government. Sending out the masks to people is like a tangible thing that's very smart. Where it's like, if you want to sow...
It's better than poetry.
Way better than weird poems in the mail.
If you want to sow chaos, and he does... don't send people weird poems. Send them symbolic masks that kind of make them feel empowered to do things they maybe otherwise wouldn't.
Yep. And also it makes it harder to identify him. Yes. And it makes it more like, this isn't just me. I'm not the only one. Anyone who puts on this mask is a part of this.
Oh, yeah. And that's why I love that.
It's like Spider-Man.
Yeah, I was going to say it's like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Anyone can wear the mask.
That scene. You can wear the mask. At the newsroom where he broadcasts and puts his mask on all those people. It's such a cool, cinematic scene, but it also, how the mask shifts in the movie is like in the beginning, it's like essentially hostages are wearing these masks so that the police doesn't know who is who. And then thousands and thousands of people are wearing these masks because they are all him. And so I feel like that's a really cool device within the movie.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
That's another really well small logistic thing, though, he sent like 70,000 masks. Yeah. And this is like, I guess in 2005 when it was made. For me, it was about the logistics of getting all
the masks. Where did he get those masks?
And like also just people are different sizes in their bodies. And he didn't just send masks. He also sent like capes and hats.
Wow, it's amazing.
And like, I have a very large head. Most hats do not fit my head. So I'm just like, where did he get all these one size fits all hats and capes?
They're like baseball hats in the back. They have like snaps
and hats. I just noticed that they're sending out the masks. I assumed that everyone just like went out and bought those capes.
No, you can see the cape in the box when it's opened. Yeah. He sent the capes.
Well, I will say there is something about this movie that I enjoy in terms of the heightening of it to make V a little bit of a superhero, like not a full superhero. And he does die. He is mortal, but like he is like those matrixy moves and whatever. Like,
oh yeah, with the knives and the swishing, and you can see the swishing of the knives.
Because in the book, he is larger than life. He is like, does feel kind of like a demigod. And so it is all of these moves then feel of a piece. It's like, I believe the way you can move around a room makes me believe you can set up those dominoes and makes me believe you can figure out how to ship 70,000 masks.
He does, they do mention in like a tiny aside that during
the, I know what you're
during
gonna
say. The experiments that Subject 5 got heightened reflexes and like speed.
Yeah, so they
speed.
Like give him superpowers in the movie that he doesn't. Not superpowers.
It's a little
but
X-Men.
Like,
sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's now very
I don't know if I liked that.
Me neither. I think maybe some executive was like, he's very good at dodging knives. How did he do that?
It's like, fine, we'll put it in the script.
Yeah, we'll just give it a little aside. It's like he loves, and I like that in the movie, another thing that we don't get in the book is he loves the Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, I love
which
that
is just
too.
Like kind of fun and like a little personal detail, and he likes that it's romantic and it's sweet.
You get your own tree.
Yeah. It makes me seem like a lot more fun to hang out with me if you can eat like egg in a basket and watch a movie with him than if he's always quoting Aleister Crowley at you in an aggressive way.
I mean, I love that cat power. He's got cat power on his jukebox.
Yeah.
Practicing Anthony and the Johnsons. I was like, okay, he's got great taste in music.
Practicing
cat power. Another point in the he's gay column.
Yeah, you're right.
Oh yeah.
Also, Anthony and the Johnsons.
Practicing his sword work against the knight, the armor is adorable.
Adorable. While quoting the movie at the same time, pretty cute.
I mean,
how could you be afraid of that guy?
This V is so great, and this V to me gets the ending that I wanted in the book, which is like he shows up to a situation that he will not win. Obviously, it's like all of Prothero's men. And so to have him like take all these bullets and then be like, okay, now my turn. I was like, this is the ending that I wanted for him.
Yeah.
He gets to hear his ending.
I forgot. This is the first time you've seen the movie because like I was waiting for the my turn. And like when I wish I could experience that for the first time again. And he's like, I really bitches.
And him describing how he was going to kill lots of Creedy.
Creedy.
It was so fun. And it was like, exactly, because I'm so used to watching like superhero movies where they actually can't die. And so it is so fun to see him have these like cool higher level moves, but then he is still mm-hmm. a mortal man. Like that is mm-hmm. what was so satisfying about it to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two things. One, the scene where he's like, this is how I'm going to kill you, reminded me of the scene in Charlie's Angels, the film, where Drew Barrymore's character is like, I'm going to tackle all of you and then I'm going to moonwalk out of here. And then she does it. And I'm just like, I love it when you set up a goal, a hypothesis, and then you solve it with your experiment. It's like, that's the scientific method right there.
Yeah. That scene, which you were like, yeah, it's the ending I wanted. I totally agreed. And it also, to me, felt like the best example of the screenwriters taking an element from the book and then translating it into being satisfied, where what they took mm-hmm. was like what V's plan was, is he knows that in this system there's going to be backstabbing and discord among the party members. But rather than do this like weird, elaborate puppet master ruse that wouldn't make sense, he literally goes to Creedy, sets up this backstab mm-hmm. and then reaps the results. Like we see the cause mm-hmm. and effect in a very clear way, where even though the mm-hmm. pieces are the same as they were in the book and the point is the same, the cause and effect is much cleaner, much clearer. And then we get this fun moment with this, we get a dramatic death.
Yeah.
I love that Creedy does not understand the concept of bulletproof vests. He's like, why aren't you dying? And I'm like, aren't you a cop?
But also bulletproof vests, I knock on wood, never gotten hit by one. They would mm-hmm. knock you down. They don't stop. They stop you from dying, but they also, you'll like be bleeding or bruised.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, it wasn't perfect. But also he was like, but I don't understand how you are still alive. Yeah. And I'm like, it's clearly a bulletproof you are a cop, you should know this.
I mean, that ending too of having the High Chancellor being killed by Creedy felt really satisfying too, instead of, I mean, I know they intentionally streamlined Rosemary out and Helen Hyer out of this. Mm-hmm. And I think it worked. I think the addition of them. I think for good reason.
Yeah. No, the problem in this dystopia is not the patriarchy. And I do feel like that's different than the book.
Yeah.
Where, mm-hmm. yeah, the powerlessness of women in that society is a big part of the book.
Yeah. So like not having those two, I think, was, again, a great choice on the Wachowski sisters to like not add any more extra extraneous stuff just to honor the book. I thought that was a great choice.
And the only time we even get the other body parts of the Norse Fire Party are during, like, when Adam, his name is Adam, it's not Adam Susan Sutler. Adam Sutler in this.
They made it sound more like Hitler in the movie.
Oh, I didn't think about that, but yeah, they did.
Oh, I read that on IMDb. That was not an organic realization for me.
I thought they were just like, the last name, Susan, that's not strong enough.
Yeah, I thought the same thing, where they were like, it's sort of weird. But I was saying there's like the only time we get like Dask, the names like Daskam and Etheridge, just he's like, Etheridge, how are things at the ear? Mm. You know?
Yeah, that's true. I will say the only thing about the ending that was a little unbelievable was little tiny Natalie Portman being able to pick up V. Like she did, she was not working out.
She didn't do the weightlifting.
She didn't do the weightlifting. There was no foreshadowing of strength being used.
She's just a little weight picking up a grown bleeding man.
Last week, I promised that there was more I wanted to say about the destruction and creation, two sides of anarchy, and I think that we get this lovely scene where Evie is like, God is in the rain, and she's gone out to the rain to sort of like have her renaissance moment, literally rebirth moment. But they intersplice it with the scenes of V coming out from the fire, and fire is used to destroy and rain is used to create. Ooh. And I thought that was really interesting.
There we go.
Love that.
Well said. We have both of their heroic moments. I was just going to say, then the end where he gives her the choice to pull the, I think it's great because it's, you know, the choice should be to the people. What I didn't love was, I don't mind a kiss. I think a kiss to a mask can be sweet and can be earnest. I didn't love the I love you. We don't need them to love. You can.
Okay, but Valerie loves
everyone. Like, I think the movie and the book
kiss plus
good.
I but, love
but,
you
but they don't but they don't play it. I would have, that's why I was okay with the kiss. A kiss to me would have played like a Valerie love, but the way they play it feels like a love.
They play it as a love story, especially like that moment when he, when Evie leaves and he is left alone and he like throws his mask and cries like a lover.
It's, very, it's like Beauty and the Beast.
Hated it.
It's very Beauty and the Beast.
I did not like Beauty that either.
I mean, there are roses,
where he's like,
you know?
I just wanted to see your face one last time. That's like a line actually out of Beauty and the Beast.
And she's like, I promised. I promised.
No, too good, Melissa. Make it like a little weirder.
I promised. Look at him. Prow, prow.
He really does such a good job of bringing life to that mask. Like, I know we joke around of like theatrical, but like he really did.
He really did.
He's very expressive, which is a crazy thing.
He's flipping his hair around all the time.
And also what's wild to me is that the whole, all of his audio was done in post also.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
I didn't know that. That's so cool.
That's cool. I didn't know that either.
I mean, he was saying things while he was there, obviously. Yeah. He wasn't like miming, but they had to redo everything in post.
And
so it was a great physical performance and then a great voiceover performance.
And he also then voiced over a little bit that was from the first guy.
Oh, yeah. Could you tell?
No.
Could y'all tell?
No, I couldn't tell.
I couldn't tell.
No.
I was looking.
I think it would. I think they probably just used it for like filler shot, you know what I mean? Like some basic shots that they couldn't redo.
Well, no, he worked for like 6 weeks before he left.
I know, but we don't know what they saved and what they didn't.
Yeah.
They, you know, whatchamacallit, Eric Stoltz worked for 6 weeks on Back to the Future before they fired him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did not.
Yeah, the, in her, it wasn't supposed to be Scarlett Johansson. It was someone else.
Samantha Morton.
Samantha Morton, and they were like, all of Joaquin Phoenix's acting is against Samantha Morton.
Oh, that's very interesting. Huh. I didn't know that.
Anyway, fun fact.
Yeah, a lot of fun voiceover and casting facts that we're getting here. What was I going to say? I do think this is the one time where I was like, I think this is that other dude. The scene where it's the show within the movie.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I think it's that other guy there where he's V and he's like being a little scamp and he's got his little cigar.
I'm going to say, like, I think it's neither. I think it's just a random guy.
You think that was just like a stunt double?
Well, I also think what's interesting about this is like he did such a good job with it, but it also is a character that lends itself to such great physicality because this character is so theatrical and like so there is so much body movement. I think about in comparison The Mandalorian, where I get very frustrated with that show because it's just like Pedro Pascal is behind that mask, why can't we just see Pedro Pascal? And it's like, oh, there's just a lead character that gives us nothing, but that's because it's a stoic man behind a mask and that's boring. But a theatrical man behind a mask is great.
Is really
He like flips his hair like an anime character
all the time.
Yes.
Yep.
Very fun.
Love it. Love
you
to
just
see
expect
it.
Like stars to come out. It's great. I love the hair also.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just really enjoyed the like. Yeah.
Yeah. Me too.
Little like.
Yeah.
I'm chic. I wear clothes from Chico's haircut.
I also really loved the shadow gallery. I thought it was like better than I could have imagined. And I feel like whatever location that was so cool. It wasn't like I guess since it's 2005, it wouldn't have been as. But like nowadays, that probably would have been some kind of green screened situation of some like a magical sort of place. But I like that it just felt like a real cool old English building.
It also to me feels much more homey and exciting than the shadow gallery that we get in the book, which like I can't picture its dimensions. But the shadow gallery in the movie, like I want to live
just
there.
Invent feels dimensions. They just invent new dimensions in the third book. They're like, did you know there was an elevator here? Nope. Well, here it is.
And the end, I think, Creedy's journey, which doesn't involve LSD, but he still figures out, he somehow without LSD figures out where V's hideout is.
Finchy.
Not Creedy, right? Finch.
Sorry, not Creedy. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Finch figures it out even without LSD, gets there, but lets Evie pull it because at this point mm-hmm. he had come on this journey and realized that this government needed to fall. And I think that that is a very hopeful and cathartic mm-hmm. moment. And then it's paired with this tearjerker of a finale.
Yeah.
The music, really it all works finale. For me.
Oh, it's really nice.
I think what I like the best is that the shots of Gordon and Valerie in the audience are so fast.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make it, you know, it doesn't condescend.
Yeah, I really like it.
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it does blend them with the other people that we've been watching watch television, the family, the little girl. Yeah. Like, yeah. I think that's really, what you were saying is right.
Oh, we never talked about the little girl dying.
Yes, she
dies. I know.
Yeah. V describes it in voiceover, or someone else does, that with all this, like, Finch does, with all this chaos, mm-hmm. someone is going to do something and people are going to boil over. And what happens is this girl wearing a V mask is spray painting an upside down anarchy symbol, which I obviously immediately recognized as the V logo. And he shoots her. He's a plainclothes fingerman, it turns mm-hmm. out. But the crowd is furious and the crowd moves on him in a way that shows that everyday people are rising up against the government. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just going to say, I think when policemen shoot unarmed young people, people absolutely should rise up against them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was a very hopeful ending that, like, mm-hmm. all of the folks in the V masks are walking towards, like, the wall of military men, and mm-hmm. they put their guns down. And I was like, this is such a hopeful choice that we are seeing, but it's
V orchestrated it because all the hierarchy are all dead.
They can't follow orders.
Yeah,
like mm-hmm. it's like they're I was just following orders, people, but there are no orders. So in that moment, they have to choose
because they're like, mm-hmm. like they're like, Adam Sandler's not coming through, and they're like, go to Creedy, and they're like, Creedy's not coming through. You know, like it's like he mm-hmm. figured out the system where it's like with no orders to obey. They just were like, oh, we don't, it's like toys without anyone to play with.
I mean, I think it's a very hopeful.
Oh, it's very optimistic. Oh,
yeah,
yes.
It is. Yes. It's very optimistic. Yeah.
I want to go back to the young woman who died. I think that it's really interesting. In the news reports after that, they talk about riots in Brixton. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know a lot about England, clearly, because I asked the other day, in one of our previous recording sessions, does England have just the BBC or do they have other channels? So clearly, not very in the know about England. So I looked up more about Brixton, because it's a place I had heard of in, like, grime music. I'm like, yeah, I've read Brixton, blah, 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 blah. Like, I was like, okay, I don't know what that means, so... And Brixton was actually the site of riots in the 80s. So I thought that was a really interesting nod to the origins of the story.
Look at that.
Great.
I learned a thing.
Smart. Thank you.
Yeah, I think where the book, you know, Alan Moore was mad that they, you know, didn't make it specifically about Margaret Thatcher and anarchy. I think mm-hmm. that the movie working so well and resonating so well, I do think speaks to the universality of the themes, and it is feels very weird that an author wouldn't be like excited about that.
I think
it's crotchety.
It also seems like it seems like an author that is too precious with their work. That's mm-hmm. What it comes down to, because we're talking about all the changes that we really liked that we felt like made the story better. And I feel like for Alan Moore, it's basically like every change is a comment and a criticism on his work, I would assume, is what he thinks.
And, I mean, you're allowed to feel that way. Like, there are lots of writers who don't want to watch movie adaptations of their work because they just know they won't like it, and that's fine. Yeah.
Taking his name off, though, is salty.
For me, it's the taking his name off.
That's weird.
I hate this so much.
And being very vocal about it and being like, I hate it. I wonder what he thinks of the current Watchmen, because I guess
I think he probably likes it more.
I bet not.
I doubt it. I bet he doesn't. Like, this is a good movie.
Yeah.
Oh, the show or the movie?
The show. I'm talking about the show, which is also good, much like V for Vendetta is good.
Yeah.
The movie really isn't great.
The movie of Watchmen is terrible.
Oh, the movie's bad. Yeah.
But this is a good movie, and he hates it. Which leads me to believe that, like, the Watchmen TV show is so good, but probably Alan Moore and his, like, weird wizard cave is like, but in my imagined sequel, it goes like this. Like, he doesn't seem like someone who can let go of his characters.
Which is his right. I mean, he's still letting them make it. So that for me is like, he's like, look, if the people want this thing, I'll let them have it. But I'm not going to say that I condone it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny. I like the quirkiness of it. And it's like, oh, Alan Moore, you're just like letting these kids run around with their books. Be like, oh, those stupid kids, have it. Fine. Merry Christmas.
Alan Moore has said he wants nothing to do with HBO's adaptation of Watchmen.
Great.
So, fine.
Love that for him.
That's his classic.
I was ready to let him be like, yeah, people like this. This is cool. But he's consistent. If nothing else, he's consistent.
100% consistent. Yeah. Except for From Hell. He loves that one.
Really?
Really?
No. We were like, wow, Alan Moore's happy. We just want him to be happy with something.
Yeah.
But question. So this movie was made in 2005, a thing that we have said multiple times. But my question is, the world now is very noticeably different than it was in 2005. And arguably, 2005 is more similar in the way that the world was to the 1980s when V for Vendetta was written than 2005 is to now, even. So if this movie were to be made today, how do you think it would be different? Like, are there things that you're like, oh, there's no way this would fly in an adaptation today, or this feels very dated? Like, I'm curious about, like, looking at this in 2020, and for some of you having seen it for the first time in 2020, how that feels.
Okay, I saw this in theaters, and I don't remember people thinking it was a hyper-political statement. But there are so many alt-right guys who have a profile picture of V for Vendetta. So apparently there was a way to like watch this movie and be like, I love Donald Trump and V for Vendetta. And I don't know how those two things fit together in your brain.
I mean, I was going to say, I think that it probably will be adapted again very soon, and it will be a limited series for HBO. Like, I think this kind of movie, if it were made now, I think most of these kinds of like big idea movies are now limited series or several, or like Handmaid's Tale, Watchmen, and I think they would include all of the other characters. I think they would include Rosemary and Helen Hyer, and they would be all of these different sort of storylines wrapping together, and it would probably add more story than it would subtract.
I think would be also dark as hell. Like, I can imagine that it would be the adaptation for this in the limited miniseries would be like very bleak, given what we're experiencing right now.
I think we are going to get a sad cabaret. I feel like prestige drama loves like sad sexualization, like when something can be both very sexy like and very sad. Yes, at the same
HBO.
Time.
Westworld, or I think of Natalie Portman in Closer. She's like, oh, lying is the most fun a girl can have without taking her clothes off, but it's better if you do. Obviously, that was a play first. Great adaptation. Love that movie. And also, if it were made into an HBO limited series, Alan Moore would want nothing to do with it.
That's the one thing we know. That's the through line. Tale as old as time.
The thing that very famously happened was Natalie Portman actually shaved her head, and that was the real footage that they used. I just kept thinking, like, what if they fucked up? Like, she has to be crying for that. And I was just like, oh, my God, they only get one shot.
I know.
That's entertainment, baby.
Having seen that clip in pop culture just like reused over and over and over again, to see it in the film, I will say it made me laugh. I know that was the intended purpose of that. But like having seen this like crying Natalie Portman, and then it did not have the effect that I think it would have had if I had not seen all of the other crying Natalie Portmans.
Yeah. That's kind of the danger with seeing media, not danger, but kind of the collateral damage of seeing media later than it actually like later than immediately, because we memeify and like make things into GIFs so quickly and turn them into something else. And like, I haven't seen Marriage Story. I never will watch Marriage Story, but yeah, that scene where Adam Driver punches a wall has just been wrecked. I'm not going to take it seriously if I watch that movie.
Yeah, it is better than the meme. The meme made me not want to watch the movie, because I'm like, this is a dumb movie. And then I was like, oh, it's actually much better than that.
Right, and things are better in context. But something I wanted to say about the shaving scene is that it's like in the 40-Year-Old Virgin when they had to do the waxing scene. They really did that to Steve Carell, and they had one shot, because you cannot fake waxing like that.
I mean, there's a lot of those one shot things, you know, done in certain movies, and it is, I feel like everything comes down to camera focus. It's like, because that's a lot of the time why things get, you know, they need to go again, as you know, it's actually depending on the director, but like acting comes last to it usually. And I would just laugh so much if it's like they did the scene, she was full crying, shaved. It's like, oh God, we're a little soft on the focus.
It's fine. They used three cameras. Oh, they used three cameras for that scene.
That makes sense.
That's a good idea.
One has to get them.
Yeah.
Yep.
So before we wrap, any final notes on V for Vendetta, the film?
A+ adaptation.
Good movie.
Really enjoyed it. Would suggest it to all friends.
The best adaptation of the ones that we've watched, I would say.
Yes.
I mentioned last week there are a small handful of films that I think are better than the books they're based on. V for Vendetta, I think, is one of them. Fight Club is another. Yep. And it's a pretty small list.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a very, very short list, i.e. one film that is exactly true to the book. They are exactly the same. And that is Holes. Holes is a perfect adaptation. I've said it before. I think I said it when we were talking about like normal people. If y'all have not seen Holes and read the book, it is perfect. Like, I will not, I will die on that hill. I will die in that hole.
Well, on that note, I've been wanting to say Vanarchy in the UK this whole time and have not found a reason to say it.
Oh my
God. Oh no.
I think the end is perfect.
But Vanarchy in the UK. That's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dana Schwartz, and you can find me on Twitter at Dana Schwartz with 3 Z's. You can follow Jennifer Wright at Jen Ashley Wright. Karama Danqua is at Karama Drama. Melissa Hunter is at Melissa FTW. And Tian Tran is smart enough to have gotten off Twitter, but she is on Insta at Hank Tina. Our executive producer is Christopher Hesiodis, and we're produced and edited by Mike Johns. Special thanks to David Wasserman. Popcorn Book Club is a production of iHeartRadio.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.